Before introducing our speaker, let me just remind you again, as so many chairmen and presidents of this institute have, that although it is a voluntary body, that does not mean that it operates without funds. And although we are happy to have people come and listen to our talks without being members, we are even happier if they come after having taken out a membership. Memberships are not expensive, particularly when you consider the number of very outstanding lectures that you receive over the course of the year. A student membership is only $2, a single membership is $10, and a family membership is $15. You may think that this session, winter term, is just about over and it would be inappropriate to take out a membership now. Let me remind you, there are 6 more outstanding speakers to come before the end of this term. Even if you consider yourself as only paying for them, divide 6 into the figures I have mentioned, and this must be one of the great bargains of the 20th century. So, I have been assured that we will have somebody at the desk out in the hall willing and eager to take your money and to give you the correct change after the talk is over. Now, our speaker this evening is Richard J. Blandow. Dr. Blandow is recognized internationally as an outstanding educator, scientist, and physician. He is a professor of biological structure at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and his major scientific work has been in the field of reproductive physiology and morphology. Dr. Blandow was born in Erie, Pennsylvania, and raised in Washington State. He received his liberal arts education at Linfield College in McMinnville, Oregon. His graduate work was carried out at Yale and Brown Universities, and he received his Ph.D. from Brown in 1939. During the 1940s, he served as a faculty member at the University of Rochester in the Department of Anatomy while he undertook and completed his training as a physician. He received his M.D. in 1948. His academic career at the University of Washington began in 1948 as an assistant professor of anatomy, and he rose to the rank of professor in 1951. He taught developmental anatomy, microscopic, and gross anatomy to graduate and undergraduate students in the professional schools as well as the colleges of arts and sciences. In addition, he also served as an associate dean in the School of Medicine for 10 years. He has been recognized as an outstanding teacher and academician and has been a major influence in the development of the School of Medicine at the University of Washington. His awards and honors are many. The American Society for the Study of Sterility has awarded him their Isidore Rubin Medal in 1952, the Ortho Research Award in 1956, and the Ortho Medal Award in 1969. He was a recipient of a Vienna Film Festival Award in 1959 for his work in cinematography of ovum transport in vivo. He was a Barron Foundation medalist in 1969 and most recently received the 1976 Henry Gray Award for his outstanding achievements in anatomy. Dr. Blandow is a member and leader in a large number of academic and professional societies. He is past president in the American Association of Anatomists, the American Fertility Society, and the Society for the Study of Reproduction. He is on the editorial boards of a number of journals and has been a national lecturer for the Society of Sigma Psi. This evening, we are honored to hear him speak to us on the subject, the threat of overpopulation. Dr. Blandow.
Professor Cairns, and ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege for me to be here this evening and have the opportunity of talking to you on a subject that is very dear to my heart, perhaps mostly because I have been working in the field of reproductive physiology and reproductive problems in the human for more than 40 years, and you cannot have done this without having a tremendous experience. And one of the things I want to convey to you is that despite the fact that all of you are here this evening because of the reproductive processes of some particular couple, the amount that we know about human reproduction is remarkably small. And I want to point out particularly that the thing that concerns me tremendously is a problem of overpopulation on this earth. It is impossible for us to conceive adequately what this means. Every second, 4 new babies are born on this earth. Sir, may I hand you 4 babies, please? The second is gone. May I hand you 4 babies? You're not willing. Therefore, I have 8 babies for you within 3 seconds, you see. This is the way it would go, so that within the 40 minutes that I'm going to be with you this evening, more than 2,500 babies are going to be born. And if they all appeared suddenly within this room, I'd have to leave because I couldn't be heard. What would happen from last night, from 8 o'clock last night until 8 o'clock today, 8 o'clock this evening? 200,000 babies have been born. And within a single year, 86 or 87 million new babies appeared upon this earth, many of whom are not going to survive. So the tremendous question that we have before us, what are we going to do with this problem? This country, you cannot conceive. You are too well fed. You are too well bred. You have 2 beautiful homes. You cannot conceive of what the problem is in the underdeveloped countries. Now what I would like to do is to, first of all, show you what the problem is. I don't want to bore you with a lot of statistics. This is not much fun. But what I want to show you first is how I conceive of the problem of the expansion of population on this earth and what eventually it's going to mean to all of us. And then I want to show you what I consider and what is most interesting to me is a remarkable phenomenon of reproduction itself. And I want to show you this in some lantern slides and also in some motion picture so that we all can appreciate the fact that if we are here this evening and are an intelligent human being, that indeed we have undergone one of the most remarkable phenomena and the most complicated phenomena that can ever be achieved by any human being. So let me begin with a series of lantern slides first, and I would like to show you what the problem is. I think I will have to move around this way. Approximately, if we go back 800 years before the birth of Christ, I was amazed to find that the prophecy of overpopulation was already brought to our attention at that time. Woe unto them that join house to house, that lay field to field, till there be no place, that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth. Isaiah. What a fantastic statement. Now, what was Isaiah talking about? This is what he's been talking about. You go to Korea, to Japan, to China. This is a house to house upon which Isaiah was describing. He did not see this. We see this today. But his prophecy certainly has come true. And this is the problem that we come up against in many of the underdeveloped countries. This happens to be India. If you have ever had the opportunity of visiting India, particularly such cities as Calcutta or Bombay, you come away in the most depressed state that you possibly can, for the simple reason that it seems almost impossible that anything can be done about the population problem in that particular area. Now, what are we dealing with? We're dealing with a significant number of births. And of course, there are simultaneously a certain number of deaths, but they don't keep up with the births. Therefore, there is a significant population increase. And here, for example, as I have indicated, every second there are four new babies born, and there may be one and a half or two people that die. The total increase in population as you go from second to second, from day to day, and from year to year, finally reaches a point where every year we have an increase in population of approximately 90 to 96 million people above those that have died. Now, what further does this mean? Let us look at it in a little different way. This is a scale which many of you no doubt have seen, and it indicates that the population increase is almost exponential. In other words, it increases so rapidly that it increases more than if you had a straight line increase. So here it indicates 88 million per year. And if we did this kind of a procedure, if we took in 1978, for example, or let's go back in 1977, in the year of 1977, the year the world or this earth attained a status that it never had before, and that was that for the first time 4 billion people were walking this earth. Now if you take, and this is really nothing to be particularly proud of, I think it is a tragedy in reality. But if you take the 96 or 86 or 96 million, doesn't make all that much difference, and you bring them over to the United States and put them in all of our states, this is what it would look like in 1978. And then in 1979, if you would add the next 96 million, these are the number of states that would be occupied with people, and what would you have left? A little bit of this western portion of the state. All of the rest would be, the population would be doubled. And that's almost inconceivable with us when you think of you're already standing in line for your groceries and for the checkout stands and things of this kind. Next, please. Now, 86 million people per year is just about the population of Pakistan. And if you've ever had the opportunity of going to Pakistan, and see the crowd of people and the conditions under which they live and the poverty under which they exist, it seems to us to be a most depressing, insoluble problem. But the interesting thing is, just as an example, you people in Vancouver do not have all the beauty. This is a show, some of the coastline of the good old Seattle area. And what I want to point out is that several years ago, one of the largest grain ships in the world came to Seattle to be loaded with grain. And this made front page news. How much grain? 125,000 tons of wheat. So I called the manager of these silos, and I said, do your silos contain 125,000 tons of wheat? And he said, not at all. This ship has to go to Tacoma, it has to load up in Portland and so forth in order to make up, to fill the bowels of this ship. And I said, where is the ship going to? He said, it's going to Pakistan. It's amazing to me. It's going to Pakistan. And he said, my goodness, in Pakistan, a lot of people are going to have a lot of food to eat in Pakistan. So I did a little calculation. And the remarkable thing is that if we divided this 125,000 tons equally and democratically to the 96 million people in Pakistan, how much would each of them get? Each of them would get this much wheat. How many calories within this much wheat? About 4,200 calories. How much would this allow them to survive? Approximately 2 to 3 days. But I can guarantee you that these 2.5 or 3 pounds would not be equally divided, because not only of the political situation, but because before the wheat was adequately disseminated among the people, that a great deal of it would have been spoiled. Much of it would have been eaten by rats and spoiled by feces of animals. So this is the kind of thing we're wrestling with. And the people in this country say, well, look, we're giving 125,000 tons of wheat. But the point, in fact, is that is just a drop in the bucket. Now, if you go to India, for example, In Calcutta, the population problem is so horrendous and so depressing. Here, for example, is a crowded street corner where animals walk, where cows are kept because of their beauty rather than the fact that they can make hamburgers or protein. And what else do you see? If you look very carefully, you'll see a dead baby on the street there, you see. That has yet not been picked up by the morgue attendants that come through the streets. 500,000 people in this particular city. Hundreds of thousands of them have no homes, and they live their whole lifetimes on the streets of Calcutta. And to me, this was one of the most remarkable pictures that I have seen. What is the woman doing? She is using cow manure to make plates of cow dung, which will dry in the sun and which can be used for fuel rather than for fertilizer. And when I saw this, I thought, what a remarkable phenomenon. They don't have enough to eat. They don't have enough fertilizer. They can't afford to buy the fertilizer. But they have to use the cow dung to heat the little rice or the little food that they have for their one-a-day meal, you see. So that we thought some years ago that the Green Revolution was going to resolve the problem, and for several years it did a tremendous amount, and this government and many other governments sent tractors over to India so that they could improve their nutritional composition. But what happened? Inflation caused fuel to rise to $2 to $3 per gallon of diesel oil. So they had to park their tractors and go back to using their old oxen in order to obtain whatever food they can from the ground. So that inflation around the world has practically negated the Green Revolution. One of the things that is happening in many countries, and particularly in this country, it was a very great concern to many of us, is the fact that so much of the good cropland is being covered over by cement and by homes. I come from the Puyallup Valley up there in the Pacific Northwest, which has the most fertile, beautiful soil to raise the vegetables of all kinds. And what did our world, our beautiful city and state planners do but to cover over most of this beautiful land with I-5? Cement. And then the most fertile valley is now being built up, or has been built up in the last 10 years, for all kinds of business ventures. And I cannot go by there without thinking, gentlemen, within another generation, when the population problem is so acute, you're going to have to dig all this up, and you're going to have to take your cement and put it in a pile, and you're going to have to begin to grow vegetables and food to feed the people. Otherwise, you're going to have a revolution. So this is another problem. You know, it was a very interesting thing to me. A few months ago, when we read about the earthquake in Italy, what a devastating thing this was. How many people were killed? 7,000 to 8,000 people. And this made front page news, and it's horrible. This was a horrible adventure for any society, for any people. But when we stop to think that every day more than 15 million children die because of starvation on this earth, where do we put our priorities? This is a fantastic problem, unbelievable problem. So the question then arises, what's happening on this earth today? When you go to many of the underdeveloped countries, revolution is shifting people from one country to another, and you're well aware as I am of the millions of people that are starving to death. It is very likely that within the next 2 or 3 years, 25 million people are going to lose their lives because they don't have enough to eat. And not a single person in this room has gone hungry today, I believe. We don't know what it is to be hungry. Now, the interesting thing is, in many countries, they're attempting to reduce the number of children. You go to India and you try to reduce the number of children in India. You go to the hinterland. where there are hundreds of different dialects, and you indicate to these people they've got to reduce the number of their children, they say, leave us alone. We need to have 6 or 8 or 10 children so that eventually we may have 1 or 2 who will take care of us when we grow old. This is indeed a very interesting problem. If you go to India, you will see signs along the street, 2 or 3 children. That's too many. What will happen if you have only 2 or 3 children? Now, this is a very interesting chart. If we take the U.S. population itself, and we take 2 versus 3 children per family, and you have a choice as to whether or not you have 2 or 3 children, or you have no children. But let us just assume that you are determined that you are going to have either 2 or 3 children. What happens? If you have 2 children, taking everything into consideration, assuming that there's a future reduction in mortality, as there's going to be as medicine improves, and secondly, there's going to be a continuation of immigration, and we take that into consideration, and the population is going to stabilize at about 350 million in the year 2070. Well, now the recent census has been taken in the United States, and we have about 265, 270 million people. And I don't want to be around when we have 300 million. And if the people decide to have 3 children, well, then we're going to have almost 1 billion people. And how are we going to feed them? This is a crucial question. Where are we going to house them? What are we going to do with them? Now, what is all this related to? Of course, I'm in the field of medicine. And to me, one of the remarkable things, I've had the most fantastic life that you could possibly imagine, because I'm really an old man. And I have come through an era of advances in medicine that really are spectacular. And let me show you just a few of some of the resolutions that have come about. Smallpox. In the Middle Ages, smallpox was a curse upon the generations. Millions of people died. Those that survived were terribly pocked or were either blind or deaf or had other disabilities. But smallpox now is eradicated. This is a result of one of the people that did survive. But the interesting thing is that in 1967, the red areas are the places where there still was smallpox available. And then in 1972, notice how the smallpox areas have shrunken. And then eventually when we come to 1975, it is practically gone. And in 1978, the last person that was photographed with smallpox is this individual. What a fantastic achievement. If we could back up just one. So that the only individual that had smallpox and was this man. All the other individuals on the earth have been freed from smallpox. And if we are careful that the smallpox viruses do not escape from the laboratories where they are still kept, smallpox has been eradicated from the earth. What a fantastic achievement. But an interesting thing is, just a year or so ago, in Birmingham, England, 1 or 2 technicians got next to some of the smallpox viruses that were kept in a refrigerator in the freezer there, and they got smallpox. So what the World Health Organization is doing now is trying to establish only 1 or 2 laboratories on the earth where the smallpox virus is kept, and it's kept under the greatest secrecy and under the greatest care so that it will not escape. Smallpox has been eradicated. No further will people die from smallpox or will become deaf or blind or will be injured permanently from this particular viral disease. Another very interesting disease is yaws. This is a spirochetal disease. And this is a disease that in the tropical countries will affect about 500,000 people. It's a debilitating disease. But we can cure this disease with a dollar's worth of penicillin. So that people can now, if they have yaws, can be treated readily and can go back to work and support their families. Now, I want to show you this because this is of very great interest to me, particularly because I came up during the era when this little crystal was developed. Not too many people on the earth that died from pernicious anemia. But pernicious anemia is a disease in which the red blood cells are not formed sufficiently and are not formed properly, so that there's an accumulation of iron within the liver and within the spleen and within the kidneys, so that eventually the patients become anorexic. They lose appetite and they practically starve to death. In addition to that, they have very bad diarrhea. And it was discovered that there is a component within the stomach that actually helps to convert the food that you eat into vitamin B12. And vitamin B12 then is absolutely essential for the normal production of red blood cells. It took a German chemist who was working in a pharmaceutical company there 10 years to purify and synthesize vitamin B12. Before that time, when I was a student in the School of Medicine and a patient came in with pernicious anemia, we had to beg that patient, if it was going to survive, to eat a half pound of raw liver every day. Now, you try to convince a woman to eat a half pound of raw liver every day, no matter what you do, ketchup on it or mustard on it, to eat that much raw liver to survive. But when the crystal was formed, this little crystal that fits into the eye of a needle is sufficient to keep a patient with pernicious anemia going well for a whole year. What a fantastic achievement. And we could go on to many others. We don't have time to do it. I can just mention a few other things. Last year, I asked our fourth-year medical students at the time of graduation, I gave the commencement address to them, and I asked them, how many of you, during your 4 years of medical training, have seen a case of poliomyelitis? Not a single one of them. When I was a medical student, every summer we would get the beds ready, we would get the artificial lungs ready for the host of beautiful young children that would come in with poliomyelitis. And then the vaccines of Sabin and Soft came along, and there's no reason why poliomyelitis should be present anywhere on this earth if we have the proper public health situation in order to disseminate the vaccine. The tuberculosis hospitals are being closed. How many do we have in the city of Seattle? We have none. And it's only in the underdeveloped countries where we actually still have a significant amount of tuberculosis, but this can be solved by the treatment of drugs and also by fantastic surgery that can be done to remove the area that is infected. Bacillary dysentery actually kills millions of young children but can be cured readily and rapidly by antibiotics. Malaria can be removed from the earth by the use of quinine and atropine and by killing the mosquitoes that distribute it with DDT and so forth, so that we have a handle on most of the debilitating and most of the killing diseases that are present on this earth. Now I want to tell you, go in a little different direction. I would like to talk a bit about some of the remarkable phenomena about human reproduction itself. When a baby is born and the baby dies and you make a section of its ovary, this is what the ovary looks like. And this is just about 10 microns in thickness, a very, very thin section that has been stained. And what you see here are a number of large cells, and all these are potential egg cells or potential humans. How many are there when the baby is born? Oh, there are about 450,000. Most of these are going to undergo degeneration before they come to the time of ovulation. During the normal reproductive lifespan in a human female, how many times can she become pregnant? Potentially about 420 times. Did you ever think of that? It's an amazing. If a woman has 12, 15 babies, she's front page news. But she has the potential of becoming pregnant about 420, 480 times because she's going to ovulate that many eggs. But I'd like to make this statement, that there's no mammalian species that we know of that is as inefficient reproductively as the human species. Furthermore, there is no species that we know of that has as many congenital abnormalities as the human being, which is again a very interesting problem which you could spend many hours talking about. Now, one of the most amazing things that we have very little information about is that every month during the menstrual cycle within the human female, a certain number of these begin to grow, and one will come to ovulation. We have a pretty good idea as to why only one comes to ovulation, but we don't know why one is chosen out of these 400,000 eggs. That's a fantastic philosophical problem, if nothing else. Because the point, in fact, that any one of you are here tonight is a fantastic number of chance. And if out of this egg that begins its development out of the ovary and is fertilized by a spermatozoan that is different than any other spermatozoan that has ever existed, and that if you come as and develop into an intelligent human being, why, it's one of the greatest miracles that has ever been perpetrated. So let us assume that each month during the reproductive period, one of these eggs is chosen and it begins to grow. From a relatively small cell, a group of cells are formed around about it, and eventually this egg then will come to the time of ovulation, and it's going to look like this. And this is actually was an ovulation that we observed in a rabbit, if you will. The human ovulation is very much the same. Man has seen only one human ovulation, if you can imagine. And we have a motion picture of only one human ovulation. And we're basing all of our information on that one ovulation. But we've seen thousands of ovulations in other animals, and we believe that what we see in the human is probably very much the same. Well, what I want to point out here is the egg, you see, that has just been ruptured from this follicle. And this is going to be picked up by the upper end of the oviduct. And what I want to point out now are some of the importance of advances in ovulation. We do not know what the basic mechanism of ovulation is. We cannot tell you what the basic molecular mechanism of ovulation is. We're that are an area of very significant ignorance. Yes. Oh, I'm shining the laser beam. We're going to have a new medical problem here. And what I want to point out is that if we knew how to detect ovulation accurately in the human, or could predict ovulation in the human, we would be a long ways ahead in being able to develop some kind of a device or some kind of a technique for controlling ovulation. And in my view, this is the basic problem that we're confronted with at this moment. Now, what we have done in our laboratories and what other people have been working at very actively is, for example, working on the chemistry and physical properties of cervical mucus. And in the underdeveloped countries, the testing of the cervical mucus of the people, which are being trained to test their own cervical mucus to tell whether or not they're in the fertile or the infertile period, is perhaps the most viable technique for them to tell whether or not they are in the safe period. Groups of women in the Philippines, for example, where this is a horrendous problem. If you have six children and you can't feed the seventh, then you're highly motivated to do something about it. And if you can't buy a cooking pot in 1 year, well, then you certainly are motivated to handle the problem of an additional child by some means rather than having to go to the drugstore to buy a pill or some other kind of device. People just cannot afford to do this. So what do? They're training groups of women to go around to other groups of women, getting them together, and they are testing their own cervical mucus by taking a little bit and spinning it between their fingers. And if they're illiterate, well, then they have a little picture of a red baby, which indicates that this is a danger period. And if there's a brown baby, it indicates that they're in the safe period. And they can put this on a calendar, and from day to day, then they can identify pretty well what the time of their cycle is. Now, you may think that's not important, but to these people, it is vital. It is the essence of their existence. Now, excuse me, let me go back to that previous one. The changes in blood flow. We know that at about mid-cycle, at about the time of ovulation, there's a change in blood flow. And the bioengineers are working with us very avidly in order to develop some kind of a device which would identify the changes in the blood flow so that we could predict perhaps what the time of ovulation would be. Or the changes in body temperature. We know that immediately after ovulation there's a slight change in the body temperature. But all of the techniques that we have are either retrospective or prospective. They don't really tell us precisely the time of ovulation. And if we know the precise time of ovulation, that's not very helpful. Because if the spermatozoa are around, the egg is going to be fertilized and you're going to have a pregnancy. But there's a very interesting new area that's developing, and that is the area of pheromones. And pheromones, let me just briefly describe what they are. Pheromones are chemicals. They are sex attractants that you find among insects. And let me just tell you this story. You probably have read, for example, that a female moth will give off some kind of chemical when she's receptive to have her eggs fertilized. And this will be disseminated in almost molecular quantities out through the air. And a male moth a mile away will sense this and will, by his little radar technique, will come right up to where the female is and will mate with the female. We had a graduate student in the state college who was working on the problem of moths that were killing some of the fir trees in the Cascade Mountains. And he caught a group of these females and he brought them into the laboratory. And he was going to extract this pheromone. And he got some of the pheromone on his hands. And he washed his hands 1,000 times. Every time he would go out in the woods, here would come all the males around attracted to his hands. And what it really means is that the quantity of the material needed in order to be an attractant is so small that it's almost molecular in essence, you see. Physiologists and pharmacologists and medical people tell us that the human also has pheromones, and I could show you this very nicely. We don't have time to go into it. The human being has many pheromones. We have not been able to identify them and to classify them and to bring them down to a point where they are useful, but I would venture to say that within the next generation or so, we will be able to somehow detect the human pheromones that are related particularly at the time of ovulation. I'm fairly confident that time is going to come when we will be able to obtain some sweat from the fingers or some saliva and can identify the changes in chemistry in these secretions, which will give us a clue as to whether or not ovulation is impending. I think this is on its way. But one of the basic problems that we had or that we have is, may have the light problem, is how can we identify ovulation? Ovulation is prospective or retrospective, as I've indicated. And if it is under this condition, how can you develop any kind of a device that is suitable to all cultures? It's very difficult to do. So with the help of the bioengineers in our laboratories, we have developed a rather interesting little device which looks like this. The majority aren't going to be able to see it, and I'm sorry I don't have a picture, but let me describe what this is.
I think there's a picture.
This is, oh yes, there we are. This is what we have here. I have a little horseshoe-shaped gadget here, and this little horseshoe-shaped gadget looks exactly the same as that. And the LED is a little light-emitting diode. It's the same as a little red light that you have on your radio and TV. And that little brilliant light shines across to the opposite side where there's a photosensitive gadgetry that can pick up the light which crosses the hollow between the horseshoe. And that can then be transmitted to a little radio transmitter that I have here. And if I turn this on, don't turn that on yet, please. If I turn this on, some of you may be able to see that there's a little flashing red light. Why do we have it flashing? We have it flashing so that if we attach this to the oviduct as we will do in the next slide, let's look at the next slide, we can attach it to the upper end of the oviduct near the fimbria, which is up there in the upper corner. This is the fimbria of the oviduct here. And if we attach this little gadget right here and put it on with a little tissue glue so that there's no injury. Now let's see the next slide. It would look something like this. Here is a little gadget attached to the oviduct. And the upper end of the human oviduct will fit beautifully into this, or the primate oviduct or the rabbit oviduct. It doesn't make any difference. We usually use primates, use monkeys. And put it on with a little bit of tissue glue so there's no injury. Then as an egg passes down, that is ovulated, that passes down into the oviduct itself, as it passes this flashing diode and the change in the light transmission is picked up by the phototransistor on the opposite side, we get a record that looks something as follows, where you can see the record right down there at the bottom, I believe. Here's a young, let's just look at the previous one. What we see, you see, here is a signal which is transmitted to this receiver. And what we know from a lot of work that has been done in animals, that animals are very sensitive at the time of ovulation to any kind of extraneous environmental conditions. Therefore, we have this little receiver on the back of the animal. And if we look at the next one, this is our Susie, who has this little receiver on her back, which now has been miniaturized so that it's about the size of a small matchbox, and it can be implanted underneath her skin so she can be free roaming in her cage and she doesn't have to have the jacket on at all. And then this little receiver, transmitter, is just like a radio transmitter. And if we turn on a transmitter, you can hear that somebody in the audience is ovulating. Turn it up a little bit, will you? What you are actually hearing is a transmission of the little diode, the little glowing light, across to the receiver on the other side, the sensitive receiver, which then comes into this transmitter, which then can be transmitted to another room where a record can be made of the contractions that are occurring within the oviduct. And if an egg passes down past this sensitive phototransistor, a record of that is made, you see. Well, now you think this is a simple device. How much do you think it has cost? You'd have the lights embedded. How much do you think this has cost to just make this little thing? I apologize to the United States government, but it cost $500,000 to build this. Why? For the simple reason that in order to prepare this little bit of gadget that can be placed within the body fluids of the animal and can resist the activity of body fluids. Body fluids are the most amazing substances that can get through almost anything. This has at least 20 or 30 layers of different kind of acrylic substances on its surfaces, put on one at a time. And it took about 3 or 4 years to develop a device of this kind so that it could persist within the body of the animal for 6 months to a year so you could identify the time of ovulation. Having done this and made this now and having this on the animal, we can observe that we can determine the time of ovulation in this particular animal. And we now, the importance of this is that we have a gold standard against which we can develop any kind of other device that we can think of which will give us a clue to register the time of ovulation. I would venture to say that within the next generation or so, it is going to be perfectly possible for a woman to have something within her ear, perhaps like a little earring, which will have a miniature sensing device, which may pick up differences in chemistry, which may pick up differences in blood flow, which may pick up a variety of things that we still do not appreciate at this moment, that as the time of ovulation approaches will ring a bell or something of this kind, and she will know that she is in a hazardous state. You may think that this sounds like Buck Rogers, but the point, in fact, it is not. When you think of the remarkable things that have been done in all kinds of gadgetry, we now very recently have seen the development of the continuous insulin injectors, the cardiac pacemakers, which when I went to medical school were not available. The tremendous improvement in all kinds of cardiac valves and all kinds of sensing devices that have been developed. It's a fantastic period to be living in. And I must say, I believe that within the next 50 or 100 years, we're going to see things that now seem impossible to us. Let's go on. I want to show you this. This is the same lady. She was mated. She had one of these sensors on, and it indicates that it does not interfere with the reproductive processes. And this is terribly important, obviously, if you're going to determine the time of ovulation. So she's doing very well, and she was a wonderful animal. This was just a fantastic. You can train these animals to do anything. They'll hop up on the table. They'll allow you to put the jacket on them, and you give them a little chunk of sugar, and by the time they've eaten the sugar, you've got the jacket on and the sensor on, and they're just as happy as can be. And then it indicates that the proper treatment of animals is a very important part of this whole procedure. Now let me see the next one, because I've lost my train of thought here. Oh, yes. Now I want to, let's back up. The human reproductive system is indeed a very beautiful system. And the first thing I want to talk about a bit is the fimbria and the ovary. This, of course, is the ovary that is going to ovulate the number of eggs that I described, and this is the fimbria. And the fimbria is just like a hand with a lot of finger-like projections that almost completely enclose the ovary, particularly at the time of ovulation, and form sort of a bursa, sort of a sac around it. And the next one will show you a picture of a fresh human fimbria that was removed at the time of surgery. And I will show you this in a motion picture, and it's a perfectly beautiful thing. 60% of all of the cells on the surface here are ciliated, and let's look at the next one, and this will show you what the cilia look like. Here they are. This is just like a wheat field, you see. And these are all beating synchronously. Sometimes you'll see that has a little brush of cilia on the top. The most fantastically efficient mechanism to carry the egg quickly down to the site of fertilization. So that reproduction is indeed a very efficient process. And this is a diagrammatic representation indicating that the egg has been ovulated, is picked up by these finger-like projections, carried along by the cilia, which acts, a vacuum cleaner. There's no vacuum here, but it's the brushes on the vacuum cleaner that actually carries it forward down to the site of fertilization. And normally, spermatozoa, if they are here, they will fertilize the egg, penetrate the egg, and within a relatively few minutes, the egg will be penetrated. And the fresher the egg is, the fresher it is, the quicker it is penetrated, the more likely it is that you will have a normal baby. The longer that the egg lies around before it is penetrated by spermatozoa, the greater the chance is that it may either develop abnormally, it may not implant at all, or that you may have an individual, something that may have Down syndrome or something of that kind. So the fresher the egg is, the better opportunity it has for normal development. And then we come to the problem of sperm penetration of the egg, and it's only within the past 3 or 4 years that we've gotten the kind of information that I'm going to show you. We now can quantitate how, and we know how, the spermatozoa pass through the various membranes to penetrate the egg itself. And one of the most amazing things to me, I never become tired of looking at this process. The sperm has no brain. And yet it can seek the egg out as if it had a radar system, and it can go exactly to where the egg is located and penetrate the most complicated cellular membranes around the egg and finally find this tough outer zona pellucid of the egg. And when it gets there, it gives off some enzymes that it carries in little packets on the surface of its head, makes a little tunnel for itself through this tough outer membrane, and then penetrates the egg and starts an individual who has characteristics that are different than any other individual that has ever existed or ever will exist because of a particular genetic code that it carries. To me, an egg is an absolutely amazing, marvelous organism in that it carries within it the genetic memory of all past generations. And if it is fertilized by a spermatozoan, as I've indicated, that has a genetic constitution, a genetic pattern that is different than any other spermatozoan that has ever existed, if you will, and these two come together, they're going to produce a human being that is different than any other human being that has ever lived on this earth or ever will live. And even down to your fingerprints. And this is why the FBI can collect the fingerprints of everybody on this earth and can identify them and catalog them, because each one is different. Each one of us has a different capability. I wish we had time to go into that, because to me that's a fantastic thing. If you take, for example, the central nervous system and the development of the neurons, the nerve cells within your central nervous system. There are no two people in this room that have had the same experience. And that each of you have about 5 billion neurons within your cortex. And throughout your lifetime, 10 trillion impulses come in through your eyes, through your ears, and through the touch, and impinge themselves upon this bit of cytoplasm. And if I attend a bit of surgery where they're taking out a little bit of this cortex, and you take the cytoplasm, you just spin it between your fingers, it's just like jello, which is beginning to set within the refrigerator. And this is the stuff that will allow you to think and to remember and to imagine. And you can go to a museum and you see a beautiful painting. And 20 years later, on the screen of the neurons, you can see that beautiful painting in all of its color, its dimensions. Fantastic! This little bit of material that looks the same as any other cell, looks very much the same as skin cell, has this capability. I didn't mean to say that, but that's, to me, the fantastic phenomenon. Let's move on. We'll never finish here. We're going to have all these babies born here. You're all going to have to take home 10,000 babies. Now, after fertilization has been effected, then the egg begins to undergo division. And we have now seen a two-cell human egg. We can collect an egg from a human ovary. We can put it in a dish. We can add some spermatozoa. And we can then observe its development under the microscope. And this is where the so-called test tube babies are arising. And this in itself is a fantastic phenomenon. There's a lot of baloney related to that, but we don't have time to go into the baloney. But nevertheless, we can do this in the laboratory in animals. And the egg will then continue to divide. And it will divide in a sequential pattern until eventually it comes down to the uterus. And after it's been in the uterus for about 6 or more days, then it begins to implant within the endometrium. And then it's just like a little parasite that will bury itself into the endometrium. And pretty soon it'll develop a vascular system. And within 23 days, a little heart will make its appearance. And the cells of the heart will begin to beat. And blood vessels will make their appearance. And after a brief period of time, the thing begins to grow. And you never grow more rapidly in your whole lifetime than you do during the first 8 weeks of development. There's never more rapid cell division, no matter how tall you become after you're born, than during the first 8 weeks of development. This is a two-cell egg, and you see, each one of these two cells has retained the genetic history of development, and we can separate these two if we want, and each of these will develop into identical twins, you see. Now, I think I'm going to show you a little bit of motion picture because my time is getting rather short. But let me, can we turn this other?
Oh, can the rhythmic we turn movements that? Of the follicle are due to the respirations of the anesthetized animal. The cells comprising the superficial germinal epithelium and the underlying connective tissue gradually break away.
Is he there?
The thin follicular fluid escapes with a spurt.
Michael, would you turn the sound off, please? Thank you. What I want to show you is the mechanism of ovulation. This is actually a rabbit follicle.
Note that the edges of the stigma are quite smooth and pale in appearance. In a few moments, will observe that the cumulus mass of cells containing the egg will be ovulated much more slowly. After the initial follicular fluid escapes, ovulation of the cumulus mass is a relatively gentle process, a flowing out of the follicular contents.
Chuck, can you go back and tell them to turn it off?
When the stigma once ruptures, the time required to complete ovulation is less than 2 minutes.
What we are seeing here is some of the follicular fluid that has escaped in some of the cells. In a moment, I'm going to show you what the egg looks like. And the egg is going to make its appearance.
The egg will escape from the follicle momentarily. It will be visible
now
as a small, round, whitish object appearing over the edge of the follicle just now.
There's the egg.
The egg is enclosed in a tightly bound layer of epithelial cells, the corona radiata. Mm-hmm. More and more, the cumulus mass is expressed. But throughout all this, the follicle is not completely emptied. Part of the sticky matrix is retained within the follicle so that the ovulated mass remains adherent to it.
There,
The reason I had him turn the sound off is that I want to show you a number of things that are not that don't have sound on them. And I'm sorry that we had this interruption. Now, what I'm doing here, I've taken a little watchmaker's forceps and I'm pulling on this mass. And this is the mass that has to be removed by the surface of the fimbria of the oviduct. This little bit of bleeding does not interfere with the process of sperm penetration. But the spermatozoa have to penetrate this sticky mass in order to get to the egg and to find the egg. And that, indeed, is a remarkable thing. Now I want to show you the only human ovulation that man has ever seen. We're looking into the abdominal cavity of actually, this was an infertile woman, and this was taken by Dr. Frankenheim in West Germany. And this is a human ovary, and here is a point of ovulation. This is a relatively large follicle that makes up about a half of an inch in diameter. And in a moment, we're going to see the follicular material escape from the follicle. I believe there's a little excessive bleeding, perhaps due to the air or the carbon dioxide that was pumped into the tummy of the lady in order to expand it so that they could look down upon this area. This is really a remarkable photograph. It's the only one that gives us a good impression of the mechanism of ovulation as it occurs in the human. Now, what we're going to observe is the way in which the eggs actually are picked up. Here's a fimbria of the oviduct that lies over the surface of the ovary. And there's the ovary that's rolling up, and here are a couple of large ovulatory follicles. And this is the oviduct down which that egg is going to pass as it becomes fertilized and as it continues its development. And the egg is going to lie within this area for approximately three days. And what we've done here is to pull back the fimbria, and we see that some of the ligaments play a significant role. They also have some muscle tissue in them, and they move backwards and forwards under this superficial fimbria here. And this then becomes one of the most efficient mechanisms for picking up whatever is ovulated. We allow it to fall back onto the surface of the ovary, and you will see that it actually forms a bursa so that it's impossible for the egg to fall into the peritoneal cavity. Now what we're going to do is to flip over the fimbria, and it's really a magnificent thing. Fluted, highly vascularized, fringed. We've taken a freshly ovulated egg and we've stained it supervitally with a little methylene blue so that we can see it better, and we see it moving over the surface of the fimbria. And what's happening now, you see, is that the fimbria actually is massaging the surface of the ovary and makes it possible for it to come in contact with all portions of the ovary so that irrespective as to where ovulation occurs, that the egg will be picked up and safely delivered to the site of fertilization. Now we're going to take a small segment of this and we're going to enlarge it somewhat more. And I think this is aesthetically beautiful. I had an artist make a painting of this, and I hung it in my dining room for a while. I had some difficulty in explaining it to my guest. But here's an egg in cumulus, you see, and it's stuck over this little bit of the fringe of the fimbria. And you see that it's going to slip over the fimbria. It's going to be carried over the surface by the action of the cilia, and I'll show you what that looks like in a moment. It moves up one of the folds, it skis down the fold, and then it eventually disappears into the ostium of the oviduct. Now we're going to take just a tiny bit of this, of one of these folds, and we're going to look at it in the living with a different microscope, which is called a phase microscope. And we're going to observe what some of the cilia look like. And this is what they look like. All of the cilia, hundreds of thousands of them, all beating in one direction, you see. And if we focus down on some of the glands that are secreting the material in which the egg is moving, you see how they are being beat upon by the action of the cilia. Put a few red blood cells within the medium, and you see that the red blood cells are all moving in one direction. The remarkable thing is that irrespective as to where the egg comes in contact with the surface of the fimbria, that all of the ciliated cells are beating toward the surface until eventually, you see, the ovulated egg is perfectly smooth, just as if it has been vacuumed from the surface. And then the egg begins its migration down into the oviduct itself, and this is a remarkably efficient and really a very beautiful process. I try to pull the fresh cumulus mass away from the surface, and you will recall those little cilia on top of the little brush on top of each cilium. Well, what's happening is that they're digging into this sticky matrix, so it's almost impossible to pull it away from the surface. Now, if we could focus this just a little bit, this is a little bit out of focus for us. What we can do, we can separate, to remove the cells so that we can see the egg itself, because we want to observe the way in which this egg is penetrated. We do that by adding an enzyme, and the enzyme will liquefy the cement that holds the cells together. And what I'm going to do in a moment is just to tap the cover slip so that the egg is going to be moved to one side, and you'll see that the egg is practically free of any cells. And this egg then we can put on a slide, we can add some spermatozoa, and then we can observe the way in which the egg is penetrated by a spermatozoan. Now, we can put those freed eggs on the surface of a fimbria, and you see, you really can't see very much what's happening. They're rolling around a bit, but they're not moving. And what we're going to demonstrate here is that the presence of that cumulus mass, those massive cells, is absolutely essential if the egg is going to be transported properly. And in order to demonstrate that, I'm going to make some little eggs out of a glass, out of some glass beads, and here they are. Just make some little glass beads, stain them with a little lithium, and then you see that the glass beads are being rotated just like a basketball player rotating a basketball on the tips of his finger. We put a living egg with its cumulus mass on the surface, and you see that it's moved along very efficiently. So that the manner in which an egg is ovulated is absolutely essential for its normal transport over the surface of the fimbria and down to the site of fertilization. While if an egg does not have this enclosure of the sticky cumulus matrix, it will remain on the surface or it will be lost and it will not be transported. Here again, you can see how the egg is very efficiently moved over the surface down to the site of fertilization. If we slid open the first part of the oviduct, we'll see that it also is ciliated, and the egg moves along very beautifully as if it is moving along a series of tracks. And these are all being moved by the activity of the cilia that are beating in the direction of the site of fertilization. So that this whole process is an exceedingly efficient one. And it's amazing that that because of the efficiency that we can see within these living objects, that in the human, as I've indicated earlier, so few of these eggs actually come to final fruition and develop into a normal living baby. Now what we're going to observe in a moment, we're going to transilluminate a segment of a living oviduct in an animal. We're going to observe the way in which an egg is actually transported. What we're demonstrating here is that there indeed are a group of ciliated cells which play an important role. But this is the upper part of the oviduct. It's highly vascular. It's really a very beautiful object. These little diamonds here are fat cells that surround the oviduct. And you will see that the stained egg on the inside of this oviduct is moved forward very efficiently by a segmental contraction of the oviduct. And what the cilia are doing at this time is acting as ratchets that are holding this cumulus mass in place. So that within a matter of 5 or 6 minutes, the egg is down to the site of fertilization. And if spermatozoa are at the site of fertilization, they're going to penetrate this mass. And what we can we focus this just a little bit? And here now, we're going to slit this open, and we're going to observe what the eggs look like when they come down to the site of fertilization, about halfway down the oviduct. We've now slit this open, and we're going to show the appearance of the eggs at a little bit higher power. And if you could focus this just a little bit, it's a little out of focus, please. Now, I believe we're going to observe the way in which this object actually is penetrated by spermatozoa. And here is what we can do in in vitro fertilization, just the same as if you're producing a test tube baby. We collect the eggs from the ovary, and this can be a human or a mouse, doesn't make any difference. And these are the spermatozoa that are whipping away the cumulus cells around the egg. And you can see the egg in the background is this rather large cell. And within a brief period of time, you're going to observe that all of these cells have been denuded from the surface of the egg, and it's going to make it possible for the spermatozoa to come up next to the tough outer membrane of the egg and to penetrate the egg. And we'll show you how that happens. The point of fact is, this is the first time that this has actually been demonstrated in this manner. Now, obviously, if the egg is moving the way in which this egg has undergone the first segment or the first important role in the reduction in the number of chromosomes. It has to reduce its chromosomes from 46 to 23. And one of the ways in which it does it is to give off this little vesicle. Now here's a large egg, and here's a spermatozoan that's going to penetrate the zona pellucida. It takes it about 20 minutes for it to do so. And this is the first time that this has ever been observed. And you see, it's what it's actually doing. It's giving off some enzymes from a little bag that it's carrying along well on the surface of its head. And it's giving off the enzymes and making a little tunnel through the zona pellucida here. And in a moment, you're going to see it dash across this space. This is a peripatellan space, and enter the egg itself. And when you see it penetrate the egg, you will see that the egg suddenly reacts to it. And what the egg is doing, it's giving off a chemical which will, there, it's almost ready to penetrate. there dashes into the egg, and now this egg has been penetrated by spermatozoa, and you saw a little reaction of the egg, and what has happened is that the egg is giving off a substance that tans the surface of the egg itself and the surrounding zona pellucida. And within 20 minutes after the egg has been penetrated by spermatozoa, it completes the reduction in the number of chromosomes. This is a very complex process, yet it is an exceedingly efficient one. And the second polar body is being given off, but you can't really tell what's happening, and I will show you what's happening, I believe, by using a different form of microscope. And here's a spindle, which the chromosomes are located on the metaphase plate, and the chromosomes move to the opposite pole. The spindle rotates in this fashion. It gives off the polar body in order to reduce the number of chromosomes so that half of the chromosomes are now left within the egg, and another half are going to be brought in by the spermatozoa. Now, here's an egg that has been penetrated by a spermatozoa in here. This is peated up about 150 times. This is the second polar body formation, as we've already shown you, which occurs in about 20 minutes. This is the first polar body in which part of the chromosomes have been given off. You see that the first polar body is rounding up, and in a moment it's going to pop just like a balloon. Why it does so, we don't know. So many things go on, it's almost impossible to keep track of it. If you watch this in a moment, you'll see that it bursts just like a little balloon. There it goes, you see. We don't know exactly what that means, but it's kind of an interesting thing. I could say a great deal more about that, but just believe me, it's an interesting phenomenon. Well, what's happening to the sperm flagellum? The sperm flagellum is gradually being pulled into the egg. We don't know exactly how this happens. In our laboratory, we really say that the sperm flagellum is being slurped into the egg. This is the way in which it actually appears. The sperm flagellum plays no significant role in the fertilization process or the early developmental process itself. But here you can see that practically the whole flagellum is within the egg. Now, in a brief period of time, you're going to see the male pronucleus begin to form. It has a haploid number of chromosomes, one half the number of chromosomes. Here's the female pronucleus. And for some reason or other, which we don't understand, these are going to come together in the middle. There's something that's going to attract them to come together in the middle. The spindle is going to be formed. The chromosomes are going to duplicate, replicate exactly, and then a new individual will be on its way to development. And I believe that here is a rabbit egg that will show the first two cells. These are the male and female pronuclei, and here you will see a two-cell rabbit. Have you ever seen a two-cell rabbit? There it is. Now, a very interesting thing, as I pointed out, that reproduction is not as efficient as we would believe. Here's another egg that appears perfectly normal. But this egg, rather than forming a two-cell embryo, is going to fragment just like a piece of plate glass, so that this embryo then is an abnormal embryo. And this one probably would go on to normal. This is a two-cell rabbit. You can see the nuclei here very beautifully. In a moment, it's going to divide into a four-cell rabbit. The nuclei will disappear. A spindle will form. We know a great deal about what happens, and we don't have time to describe in any detail. This is going to become more and more vague to you because we see a spindle with a group of fibers forming. The chromosomes have duplicated themselves. They have lined up on the metaphase plate. They're moving to the opposite pole, and when that happens, then each one of these blastomeres divides, and now we see a four-cell rabbit. I think we will stop the motion picture now because we had some other things. We're going far beyond our time, and I apologize for that. But I just want to make one or two statements yet about the stresses. Let's just leave that on. About the stresses of this whole problem and what really is the significance. Can an audience such as this believe that walking the earth this night are 800 million illiterate people? 800 million illiterates. And if you have 800 million illiterate people, how are these people going to resolve the problem of their family planning, the problem of contraceptive devices, and whatever else is needed? And what little contribution they are making to the development of the culture as you and I know it. This is, to me, one of the saddest commentaries. You would think, well, why can't we go to the ocean and get protein, enough protein? The oceans have been overfished. The major part of the protein for Japan comes from the ocean, and they're having the greatest difficulty. They're seeking fish around the world and finding insufficient amount to feed their population. Pollution. One of the best examples I can give you is a Minamata disease, which is related to the factory in the Minamata Bay in Japan giving off mercury into the water, and the mercury getting into the fish, and the humans eating the fish, and the mothers becoming pregnant, and the babies having absorbed mercury. When they are born, they are just like a vegetable. They are shrieking maniacs for years before they finally succumb and die. Our oceans are actually becoming sinks of garbage. Schistosomiasis is a disease which is increasing at a tremendous rate because of the increase in irrigation. There are 250 million people infected. About 1 in 5 individuals in Egypt is infected by schistosomiasis, which is an incurable disease at the present time. Hopefully it will be cured somewhat later. Natural recreational areas are becoming overcrowded, as you well know, not only in this country, but in many other countries. Inflation plays a very significant role in this whole problem. Overgrazing is a deforestation. 50,000 acres in the Amazon Valley are being decimated every month. The trees are being removed. And you would think that the land in the Amazon would be ideal land to grow wheat and corn, but it is the poorest land unless you put in a great deal of fertilizer, and there's not enough money to put in enough fertilizer in order to raise crops. The lack of health services around the world is a fantastic problem. Water, as you well know, is becoming a very important component of the whole population problem. And energy, where people who are dependent upon wood alone cannot buy wood because of inflation and because of lack of wood, the deforestation that is occurring so rapidly around the world. And what it all leads down to is eventually the loss of our individual freedoms. Move on to the next one. I want to show the last slide. Is a loss of, this is a Minamata disease, a child, which is really a tragic thing, and the problem of the densely populated regions which face severe problems. And attempts to reforest areas is almost an impossible situation. And finally, then, we come to a situation where I think the most crucial problem in this whole area is that we're very likely going to lose our individual freedom that we think of so sacredly. There's no way that we can control the world's population problem without some kind of government interference. There's no way in which this can happen. And in countries where this has been done, it's done only in countries where people have lost their freedom. And if you want to live a life like this, then refuse to give money for research. And the problem is that we need not only demographers, we need geographers, we need zoologists, we need physicians, we need researchers, we need clergy, we need lawyers, we need all the intelligent people in the world to put their thought into what I consider to be the world's most pressing problem. This has been a discouraging talk, I'm sure, for many of you. And let me just tell you the story about the little wren. The little wren was building a nest. And she was building a nest beautifully, and she was building it with a hole in the bottom. And another wren came along and said, "Look, what in the world are you doing, building a nest with a hole in the bottom?" And the little wren said, "Oh, I just love to lay eggs, but I hate to raise kids." Thank you. Yes, our speaker will answer questions. We have certainly a few minutes. I'll ask you to address your questions directly to Dr. Blandau, and he will repeat the question in giving the answer for those of you who don't hear first time. Please raise your hand and keep your questions short. How does what, the first one?
What I'm driving at is how can people manage to live in a civilized fashion?
Say comparison.
Yes. There are a certain number of countries in which the population has almost equalized itself. and Holland is one of them. It is relatively dense, but the increase in the number of people in Holland is relatively stable, and has been so for a number of years.
Does immigration play a part in that stabilization?
Oh, indeed it does. Immigration plays a very significant role. And the point of fact is, one of the big problems that confronts us today is the fact that people are moved from one country to another, not because of their own will, but because of war and revolution and things of this kind. And the whole Middle East problem, the whole problem that we see in Indonesia, for example, and Cambodia, is related not so much to the people's capability as they were, as they were capable originally of spending their time in raising food, now have to spend their time in moving from one place to another. It's an amazing fact when you think of China, for example. 80% of the population spends its time in producing food for the 800 or 900 million people. And that is a lot of effort, you see. Yes? Well, the primary, this is a very good question. Of course, there's no answer. How close are we to the place where overpopulation is going to exceed at such a rate that mankind is just going to lose control, and the population as we know it now will be decimated? Heaven only knows. This might be resolved within one or two atomic wars that may occur, even within our own generation. Who knows? But when you come right down to the population problem itself, what can all this lead to? The only thing that we can observe in such places as Pakistan and India, which to me, India to me is a hopeless situation. I do not see how they can resolve their problem. Indira Gandhi has proclaimed, how is it possible for us to control the bedrooms of our population? It's almost an impossible problem. If the population continues as it is today, I think that we are headed for a fantastic, disastrous period of starvation that we are not going to be able to resolve, irrespective of the fact that we think that we have enough land to grow wheat and corn and maize and so forth in order to feed these people. It is stated by the World Health Organization that the world is in a situation, the earth is in a situation today, where we have a 120-day safeguard of food. 120 days. And what would happen if we have a continued drought as has occurred within Africa, where literally millions of people are starving because of the inability not only to get food to them, but to transport it to them? There just is not enough arable land to take care of 6 or 8 billion people. Yes?
Is it possible for two spermatozoa to enter simultaneously almost the same egg?
Yes.
And what would happen?
Is it possible for two spermatozoa to enter the egg at the same time? Yes, we've seen this in our laboratory. What happens is that we have a situation which we call triploidy. There is an additional set of chromosomes that come in then, you see, so that there are three sets of chromosomes. If there are three complete duplicated sets of chromosomes, this egg will continue to divide. It may implant into the endometrium, but the embryo will die, fortunately. If, for example, only one chromosome, say, is not released at the time when the first and second polar body is formed, then we will have a number of abnormalities that occur, and the most common one that we know about is Down syndrome or mongolism. You see, that's where chromosome number 23, there's an extra chromosome that persists. How that extra chromosome operates in causing all of the symptoms within the syndrome is a real problem. But all that we can do now is to say, here's an extra chromosome, and we can identify that this is a Down syndrome because of the presence of an extra chromosome. And there are a lot of other aberrations which are related also to an extra chromosome. But if there is a complete set of extra chromosomes, survival is not possible. Yes? Are there any solutions to the problems in India? Yes. Well, I don't see any solution, but I must say all that you have to do is to visit India. You have to talk with their people. And India will offer, for example, as you saw in one of the pictures, it will offer free contraceptive devices. It will offer free contraceptive devices on the street corner. And they are given out from 9 until 5 o'clock. See? You get the point? Do we all have to suffer? If we have any compassion for India, I think we all suffer for it, yes. If we have compassion for any country that has an overpopulation such as Pakistan, even China. China is supposed to have controlled its population problem. But how much do you know about the demography of China? We've just completed taking a census in our country. And as you well know, counting people that are as disseminated and distributed as the people in China, it's almost impossible to tell what's going on. In China, they are controlling population by not allowing the women to marry until they're 25 and the men until they're 30. It is continuously advertised and suggested that they not have more than one child. The common slogan is two children are enough. I believe two children in China are too much. If you have two children, and only two children, and then are either vasectomized or you use contraceptive devices so that you do not have more children, then you are in fairly good condition because the state will give you the state will give you extra land to grow food and will not tax you as much. But if you have three children, then you have a problem because you have to pay extra taxes because you have an extra child, you see. One of the problems in India is that they have so many small communities with so many different dialects that they don't understand one another. There's so much illiteracy in India that and the pressure of population is so horrendous, and there is so, in essence, little respect for human life, which, in my view, is one of the major problems in India. Yes? Can't hear you. Sorry. They're trying to produce food as much as they can, as I've already pointed out to you. It was hoped that the Green Revolution would resolve their food problem. But inflation has taken this away, and they have to go back to their old methods. In India, the vast majority of the people are occupied in growing food. But the problem is not only in having the land, but in buying the fertilizer, in which inflation has made it impossible for them to get adequate amounts of fertilizer. And whatever organic fertilizer there is, they use for fuel. So that the problem is just a horrendous one. Why do they keep some smallpox in the lab? They keep some of the viruses in the lab with the possibility that somewhere in the hinterland a minute bit of the virus may still be present. It is a protection against something that you hopefully do not anticipate. It should never be used. One of the most spectacular things to me and the most things I'm most proud of is that one of the students who graduated from our medical school was responsible for the final disappearance, if you will, of smallpox from this earth. And he was not the brightest kid in our class at all. But he was the person who now, in my view, should have a statue built to him and say, this is a man who has resolved one of the Earth's greatest, most horrible problems. His name was Grunwald, a good Swede. Yes?
Could I ask conquered?
Is leprosy conquered? Leprosy can be controlled. Leprosy, as you know, is caused by an acid fast bacterium, very much the same as tuberculosis. If you looked at them under the slide, you would not be able to identify, you would not be able to separate them. There are, however, is a problem with leprosy that it's difficult to get medication next to or near to enough to the organism to actually kill the organism. Leprosy can be cured, but unfortunately, there still are millions of people that have leprosy on this earth. Yes? Person in the back. Yes. Well, the question, you heard the question he raises, should this country really be directing its effort toward being generous and supplying food to the people who need it, or should it be more directed toward developing birth control devices and disseminating birth control methodology? The country is doing both, but unfortunately it isn't doing enough. If you can, a very sad thing to me is that the amount of money that the United States government, through its National Institutes of Health, is disseminating to researchers to carry out, to attempt to carry out research in methods of controlling reproduction, human reproduction, is so small. It's much less than a couple of propellers for our atomic submarines. And yet, if this is the world's most pressing problem, we should do more. But the government is really apprehensive because of the restraints put upon them by many different groups within the society. And I respect their restraints. But nevertheless, in my view, what we need is a Manhattan Project, the same kind of research effort that we put into the production of the atomic bomb, to attempt to resolve the human reproduction problem. And the difficulty is, if you develop one kind of device or one kind of mechanism, it's not suitable for all societies. And this is the most difficult thing. We thought 10, 15 years ago that the pill would resolve our problems, but as you well know, the more that the pill is used, the more that it is studied, the more we recognize that it produces in and of itself 100 additional problems that have not been thought of. Medical problems, biochemical problems within the individual who use it, and one of the primary reasons is that no two human beings respond exactly the same to any kind of medication. Yes?
I think we'll reduce it to two more questions, please.
Yes, sir.
What is the response of world religious leaders with regard to
this? What is the response of world religious leaders to
oppose population control? What is their response?
It's very difficult to understand. That is an answer for which I cannot respond unemotionally. For the simple reason that if you visit the countries where the severest population problems exist and see the problems that the people have in merely surviving from day to day, how can this be a Christian philosophy that will allow you to, I don't want to get into difficulties, that will, how can this be a philosophy that one can accept as a Christian philosophy when you see the way in which the people suffer? That doesn't answer your question very well, but it's a complicated problem. I'm sorry, where are you? Yes. What is the present doubling time of the population where? In North America. The doubling time by the best demographic evidence we have, is 2030. Not very long.
Dean William Weber will thank Dr. Bando on our behalf.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think your interest and attention and questions pay ample tribute to the quality of Dr. Blandow's address to us this evening. I think we have heard tonight a complete biologist, someone deeply concerned about the fine structural detail and the biochemical aspects of his particular field of interest, but equally concerned about the broad social implications that relate to the field. And I think that we are most indebted to him, not only for the information that he has brought to us, but for the, and I think the word is appropriate, evangelical zeal with which he has displayed his concerns to us this evening. Thank you.